This is a Sound Rebel podcast.
To work with us on your podcast, go to soundrebel.co.uk. Over the Influence is no longer just a podcast. Our online community is buzzing with people like you.
I'm Allie and I live in Southern California. I'm a huge fan of OTI. Their joyful outlook on sobriety is what finally inspired me to quit drinking. I've been a member since day one and I'm rapidly approaching 365 days alcohol-free, which is unreal. I love that Ben and Shaz are not just the podcast hosts. They also openly engage with members during the multiple weekly Zoom meetings and interact on the community member forum. You will not find a more supportive group of people. There's nothing like this in the United States. I'm beyond grateful to be a part of the Sober Rebellion.
You've heard the podcast. Now join the conversation. Go to overtheinfluence.co.uk.
Welcome to this week's episode of Over the Influence. It's absolutely brilliant to have you listening. Thank you kindly. If maybe you are discovering us for the very first time, and you've gone to your podcast provider and put in alcohol-free, sober, sober curious, and we popped up, hello, and you'll be thinking, who's this loud northern woman? Well, my name is Sharon Hartley, based in Lancashire in the northwest of England. I am 50 years old, and just before I turned 45, so more than 5 years ago now, I made a life-changing decision, but I didn't know that's how big a deal it would have been back then. I was just going to take a break from booze. I stuck with it. Everything in my life that had been impacted negatively by drinking alcohol, all of a sudden it just all changed. And all those things were then impacted positively. Hands down, the best thing I ever did for myself and my family. It's Ace. So welcome. Really good to have you listening. I don't do this on my own. My co-host is Ben Anderson. Hello, Ben.
Hi, I'm Ben. I'm 35. I live in Liverpool. I am nearly 4 years alcohol free, which is nuts because how did 3 months? That was all it was supposed to be for me, Shaz, wasn't it? A 3 month break from alcohol go to well over 3 years. It just blows my mind. I can tell you how. It's because I'm boring and I like things like data.
And yes, you do.
And 3 months in, I said, look, I'm not going to give up booze forever. My mate Shaz is alcohol free. Good for you. I'm not going to give up booze forever. I'm going to have a 3 month break and see what it does. And after 3 months, I thought, oh, this is good. This is working for me. I might as well extend it to six. And I got to six and thought, why not do 12? And on day 366, I went, I've got a whole year of data now. And alcohol free me is a better version than drinking me, so I'm going to stick with it. And that was, yeah, nearly 4 years ago that I... Oh, I'm getting confused with all my numbers.
Coming up for 4 years alcohol-free.
Coming up for 4 years alcohol-free in July, yeah.
5.5. So between us, we've nearly got 10 years of sobriety.
Wow, nearly a decade.
Bonkers, isn't it?
And in terms of how long this podcast has been going for now, we've got hundreds of years of sobriety under our belts if you add up us and all the guests that we've had on. Because we like to celebrate alcohol-free life here, don't we? Isn't that awesome?
Yes, it is flipping amazing. And that's what we do. We sing about sobriety on this podcast. We talk to the alcohol-free bigwigs, the influencers, the authors, film stars, actual rock stars. Not even lying, by the way. Just go back and take a listen. Like well-famous people that are brilliant. Ruth Jones, FYI. It's coming back, isn't it? Gavin and Stacey at Christmas.
Friend our of mate the show. Ruth Jones. Yeah.
Sorry, exactly. Our mate Ruth Jones. Yeah. Clang!
Fan Ruth Jones. Not that we're fans. We are fans of her, but she's a fan of us. Love that. She talked about us in Cosmopolitan magazine. Enough.
Because we also love... Good housekeeping magazine.
Yes. I mean, it doesn't matter. It's big and it's famous and everyone knows it and we're in it. Woohoo. Thanks, Ruth. But we also love, that's what you're about to say, Shaz, we also love speaking to people whose names you might not instantly recognise, but who are big celebs within the world of OTI.
Absolutely. We've got one of them today. 100%. Yes, we have. And we've said it before and we'll say it again. Between you and me, these are our favourite episodes. We love this when we speak to a community member, which sounds a bit of a technical term, doesn't it? Like community member, over the influence, community member, but also now friend. Delighted to welcome Annie Knowles from London to the podcast today. Annie, thank you. And how are you?
I'm really well. Thank you both for inviting me. I'm so excited to be here.
You are more Then welcome. Come on, you're more than welcome.
Let's be honest. You started this, before we started recording, you went, oh, I'm really nervous. Oh, I'm really nervous. I said, why are you talking to, you're talking to your mates? And you said that, you know, this is a bit out of your comfort zone, isn't it, to be on a podcast like this?
Oh my God. Can I tell you something? I am one of those people that is absolutely shit scared of doing things like this. So, yeah. And I realized that, you know, growth only comes when you move out of your comfort zone. And actually, you know, it's so important that we do tell our story and we give encouragement to other people. And that's what I'm here to do today. So, yeah, I'm coming out of my comfort zone to hopefully inspire other people. Yeah, it's difficult, but I'm here.
Well, we are absolutely delighted that you're doing it, Annie, because you've got a lovely story. And, you know, we talked about this a little bit before we started as well, that we're not talking about a rock bottom today, are we? We're talking about someone who removed out. Look, I won't tell it for you. When did you first come across us? Because we've known each other for a while now, Annie.
Yeah, so I joined OTI in January of 23. And I found you by accident, actually, because I was browsing resources for an alcohol experiment that I was helping to mentor on with the police force. A very bizarre thing, which I hopefully will tell you a little bit more about later. But it was just a thing by accident. I found you and I listened to the one episode and it was just your opening music was just so fantastic. It just made me feel so happy. And then I listened to the episode and it was actually about Dry January in January 23. And I shared that.
Thanks to our friends at Alcohol Change UK. Sorry, Annie, we mentioned Dry January because they email us. So you found us in Dry January.
And I shared it with the group that I was on. But the thing was, even though I found you for other people, I was so impressed and you just kind of made me feel really happy when I listened to it. You know, it was just I thought to myself, I need to find out more about OTI. And I joined that night. And then as soon as I joined, I booked onto my very first Zoom. So I joined on a Monday, booked onto a Zoom on a Tuesday morning, and you were hosting it, Ben. I was like starstruck. I was like, here we go. I've actually got the host of OTI on a Zoom call. And I think there was only about six of us on that call on the day. And I was just like, I was absolutely starstruck. But it was just so brilliant to meet you and sort of get straight into OTI from that very first day. It was amazing.
That's definitely worn off, Shaz, because Annie came to Snowdon, right? And we, you know, we did Snowdon in the morning and we were having a barbecue in the afternoon. And Annie comes up to me, she goes, you know what? You're really normal. And I went, what do you mean? She goes, well, listening to the podcast, you know, Shaz is the fun one and you're just really serious. I didn't know what I was going to get when I met you in real life. But actually, you're quite fun. I went, oh, cheers, Annie.
Quite fun.
Yeah. So well, that's worn off. But Annie, you know, in terms of then, so that's January 2023. We'll talk about your, I suppose it is, you are combining your work and this is now a passion of yours that you've benefited from in your personal life, but you are now going and inspiring lots of others, blue light services. We'll come on to that. But then tell us your story then. Where did you start? We always like asking how long you've been thinking about removing alcohol before you actually did.
Well, to be honest, I'd like to classify myself as what I thought was a normal drinker. I was a bit boring. You know, my whole teenage years were done age appropriately, if I really think back. You know, when friends of mine at school were probably out in the park drinking overproof cider and whatever, I was, you know, at the roller disco or just at home doing boring stuff, reading and preparing for exams and things. And I didn't really like the taste of alcohol when I was growing up at all. I think if you think about David Nutt's book, I was very much a conformist or a social drinker to begin with. You know, in fact, I could easily sit in a pub with a half a log of shandy for the entire evening just to keep people company. And it just didn't bother me at all. Alcohol was not a big thing in my life. I think what then happened is as I moved through my 20s and my 30s, I started to develop a taste for alcohol. But in a way, I like to look at it as I think I learned to drink. You know, I actually have learned to drink throughout my decades. So I'm 54 now. And, you know, my drinking went from that social and conformist drinking through to enhancement, and then it led to coping. And, you know, for me, the crunch came in my 50th year, which was right in the middle of COVID, smack bang in the middle of COVID. I work in the NHS. I'm a sonographer. So for any of our international listeners, that would probably be called an ultrasound tech in some countries. But in the UK, a sonographer is somebody, we all scan ultrasound, but in the UK, I report my own ultrasounds and speak to the patients and guide the next steps and whatever. During COVID, we were thrown into new roles and new responsibilities. And I, in particular, had to go back to an old role that I'd previously had, which was as a site lead of a really busy hospital. And it's an acute hospital that was accepting COVID patients. And so, you know, the role of leading a very large department, which consisted of not just the sonographers, but the admin staff, you know, the radiologists, it was like, you know, anybody that works within that field, you know, I was responsible for. And there was ever-changing policies, lots of different procedures. In the very first wave of the pandemic, we didn't have any PPE. We had very worried staff. A lot of our staff, you know, came from homes with vulnerable relatives. You felt like you were kind of having to be a parent to a lot of these staff, as well as trying to get on with business, you know, of the day. And I think, you know, just being there, having to deal with everybody else's problems when somebody comes to tell you that they're scared to come to work, but, you know, you've been told by the government that actually all NHS staff have to come to work. It was just a really difficult situation to be in. And I find that actually, you know, I was working with adrenaline, I think, you know, during that first wave of the pandemic, when everybody was sort of coming to terms with that first lockdown, you know, in the walls of the hospital, we were kind of running at speed. We were having to move in different directions whenever a new policy came out, and they were changing every day. I mean, literally, I was having, you know, staff meetings morning, midday, and in the evening before people went home, giving new instructions and, you know, new jobs to people to do. And a lot of these jobs, you know, I didn't even know how to do myself. I was having to learn, you know, on the hoof, basically, as we were going. And so it was a very stressful time. But at the time, you know, like I said, I was running on adrenaline. I felt like I was doing the job of a superhero in during work. But it's when you went home, you had to decompress. And what I found was that I'd started to rely on alcohol every single night when I got home. Whereas, you know, I definitely had been a big drinker, definitely in my 40s, that's where it crept up for me. But I think, you know, I'd always managed to have a couple of days off, because that's what the government tells you, you know, you've got to make sure that you're not drinking every single day. And I think, you know, during COVID, it was like a mirror was held up to my behaviours, you know, and the fact that there was an issue with drinking. And that was the time that I just thought, well, I need to do something about it. I live at home with my husband and my two kids, and they don't drink. My husband used to drink. He, you know, himself would admit that he had a drink problem. He actually went to AA and has not drank since 2016. So, you know, living in a house during that first wave of the pandemic with two, you know, young adults. I mean, my son is 18, my daughter is 23. But they don't drink at home. And so there's only mum drinking at home every night. You know, the recycling bin is only full of my bottles, and you notice it, you know, and you realise that you've got to, well, I realised I had a problem and I needed to stop.
Annie, when you were talking then, you said about it being like a mirror being held up to you. What do you mean by that?
Well, firstly, because nobody else in the house was drinking. So it obviously meant that, you know, I was the only drinker in the house. But in fact, it also showed me that I'd suddenly started to rely on the alcohol for stress relief. You know, I realized that I wasn't drinking anymore for fun or for, you know, the social engagement that I would normally be drinking for if I was out with friends. In a way, if I think back to my drinking patterns pre-pandemic, you know, I'd always have a bottle of wine in the fridge, but actually nobody was really paying attention to what I was drinking. Do you know what I mean? And it's like I could easily just pick up a glass of wine and have a wine while I was making dinner. And nobody may well have been in the kitchen while I was cooking. You know, nobody was watching me. And then all of a sudden, you know, you're left in a house during the pandemic where you're all locked inside and everybody's watching you. And so you start to sort of think, okay, I'll go into the back room. I'll pretend I'm doing some washing or ironing, and I'll drink it alone on my own so that I don't have to show everybody I'm drinking. And the minute you start to hide your drinking, you know that's not great, you know.
Annie, I think your self-awareness there is incredible, because it sounds like your husband, the kids weren't saying, "Hang on, Mom." It sounds like this was a decision that you came to yourself. I just, at that time as well, you know, the social narratives, I remember being in WhatsApp groups with family, you know, and, you know, the aunties would send round wine memes because it was the pandemic, you know, and surely, I mean, I don't know what it was like in your workplace, but, you know, did you get the kind of, oh, God, can't wait to get home for a drink tonight? Oh, you deserve a drink tonight. Oh, God, a long, long shift this one. You need to have a drink, you do. You know, was that part of the, what I'm getting at here is that actually, it was almost normalized to drink more during the pandemic, whether you were working or not, yet you still had that self-awareness to go, this isn't good for me. This is going wrong. This is going down a path that I don't want to carry on going down.
They didn't even notice. They had no idea. It was seriously just me that realized that I had hit my own personal wall. And you know, if I'm honest, I was looking in the mirror and I really didn't like the look of myself, you know, and I was bigger than I'd ever been. I felt like my skin was really bad. I was definitely 2 stone heavier than I am actually now. And it was more of a cosmetic and an aesthetic thing to begin with. I didn't like my appearance when I looked in the mirror. And I just felt awful. I'd never felt so bad. And I wasn't 100% sure if I even put it down to the alcohol. I thought it was the stress that was making me feel like this. So it was really difficult to say, you know, I had the awareness of the fact that I felt like shit. I had the awareness that I didn't want to feel like this anymore. And then I just felt like, well, something has to give here. What am I going to do about it? And so I took the decision to take a break from alcohol, but also to basically have a detox month. And there was a moment where I actually had finished a shift at work. And, you know, for that first wave of the lockdown, I literally didn't have a break. I think I worked most weekends in the first 3 months between March and sort of June, July. And, you know, working 7 days without a break at all and going to the supermarket literally every single night to pick up a new bottle of wine, that had become quite obvious to me that I was doing that. Okay, so that was the mirror being held up that, you know, I'm now going to the supermarket every night for a bottle of wine and I'm drinking it when I get home and I'm going to hide myself away drinking it in the back room so that nobody can see. But I remember standing in the aisle of Sainsbury's, actually, with my basket and reaching for a bottle of wine and thinking, I don't want this. I really don't want it. But I just couldn't help myself. I actually picked the bottle up and I put it in the basket and I just thought, what am I going to do about this? Why can't I stop myself from buying this bottle of wine? And that was the biggest wake-up call for me. It was that moment of, right, okay, This is serious now. I've got to do something about this, you know, and that was the awareness. It was standing in that supermarket aisle and knowing that I couldn't say no to that bottle of wine.
When was this? Like, when were you standing in the supermarket? Just from the timeline, because the pandemic, the first lockdown was March 2020 in the UK, wasn't it?
Yeah.
So when was this that you were standing in the aisle?
So it was the beginning of August of 2020.
Wow.
I remember it was the beginning of August, and I think the government in the UK, they just released their Eat Out to Help Out thing. So the lockdown was released and everybody was allowed to go out if they wanted to go and, you know, start buying food and booze in pubs and restaurants and stuff. But that for me was the time that I realized that, you know, that first wave had just hit me and I was ready to change.
Do you remember, Shaz, what the WhatsApp groups were like at the time?
Yeah, and I also remember at the time when it first started, unusually here in the UK, in that like March, April, in the first lockdown, the weather was beautiful. Yeah. And there was a run of around, 8, 10, 12 weeks, something like that, where the sun shone. Couple that with people being furloughed, couple that with people obviously not having to do the school run and things like that because everybody was at home. The amount of stuff that I saw that was, it's 10 o'clock somewhere, time for a wine in the garden. And it was massively celebrated. I mean, there was only something on the news, actually. I think it was possibly last month. Of course, the figures are coming through now, aren't they, with regards to, you know, alcohol-related deaths and the number of people now struggling more with alcohol. And what I saw was a real sort of split. And obviously doing what we do and the people we speak to and within the community as well, you had people whose drinking ramped up for fun during lockdown because there were, you know, restrictions and you couldn't go out and you didn't have to drive the car and things like that. And then you saw people whose relationship with alcohol already problematic worsen. And then as well, you also saw people who may have suspected, you know, like listening to what you're saying, Annie, about a worsening relationship with alcohol, use the opportunity to actually stop and reset. And it's really interesting hearing you describe it, Annie, because you're so aware. So was I, you know, I'm drinking too much. I'm back in the flipping supermarket again. It's in my basket again. And it's going down my neck again. And yet here we are again. And it creeps up and it bites you on the arse. But until it's bitten quite hard, I don't know about you, I was quite happy to sort of ignore that and just keep going.
Oh, I ignored it all the time. In fact, if I think about it, you know, I was a massive drinker with my friends. I was the one that was the party girl that wanted to, you know, stay till the end of the night. I was never somebody to turn down an invitation to a night out. You know, I didn't want, I had massive FOMO. You know, I always wanted to be at everything. You know, if I think back, I did attempt a few alcohol-free Januaries, probably from about 2013 onwards. And I say attempted because I often didn't quite get through them. So if I look back and think, you know, I obviously needed to take a break if I was even attempting that. But at the same time, I was the sort of person that used to enjoy a night out and be the last one to leave. Even the one that was on the table dancing, and you know, all of those, everything was there telling me that I was drinking too much. But I, of course, didn't pay any attention to it at the time. You know, it took something like the pandemic to be the springboard for me to take action. But at the same time, in a way, this is why I think, you know, your podcast is so great, because you've got all these people that come to talk on it that have got such a range of different experiences and backgrounds. But it's like maybe you, me and Ben, who are those people who didn't have that rock bottom. For me, it was that bottle in the supermarket basket that was that moment of, I have hit my own personal wall. And I'm going to do something about this. And actually, I imagine a lot of people that are listening to your podcast are those that really don't know where to go, because they're like us, that they know that it's too much for them. And actually, what they need to know is that you can stop, and it may just take one thing for you, and it doesn't matter what that one thing is. But, you know, it's possible. It's possible. And it's about suddenly having that awareness of what you need and what's wrong, what's going on with you, and maybe what's wrong with you, is that point that is, it's a good enough point to start this whole process.
Annie, you'll have heard me say this quote a lot. It was from Wise Tim in one of the very first OTI Zoom calls, who said, I didn't have a rock bottom, but I could see it from where I was standing. You know what, for me, because I gave up literally the month before you. And the reason I said to Shaz then, do you remember the WhatsApp groups, is because I remember in July 2020 when I decided to have this pre-month break, it felt like I was doing something really weird. Like I was really going against the grain, because the societal narrative at that time, I imagine particularly, you know, you're going into work every day, was very much about the ramping up of drinking and the acceptability that, you know, if you were on furlough, then of course you can crack open the wine at midday. It felt like I was really, really, you know, even more abnormally going against the grain because of that narrative around the pandemic. I didn't have a rock bottom, but I could see it from where I was standing. I don't think actually I could see my rock bottom, but I knew that I was kind of slowly going downhill. Do you know what I mean? Like, I don't know if my drinking would have ended up being dependent drinking, but I could also see a future where actually, yeah, I can see that happening. You know, I was drinking alone. I was drinking because I was stressed. Do you think that you listen to that little voice sooner than maybe other people might listen to it? Because that is, you know, from the pandemic starting in March 2020, in August, you decided to remove alcohol completely. And you've been alcohol free since then, haven't you?
So this is one of the reasons I wanted to come on the podcast, because I know that, you know, people think, you know, how am I going to do this? And how are people doing it? How are people staying alcohol free? And actually, what I want to say to people is I had about 18 months of attempting moderation. I wasn't really trying to attempt moderation. I was just trying to get sober, but actually it was so bloody hard. And I wanted people to know that, you know, I had this intention of wanting to stop drinking in 2020. And I managed 45 days by myself to begin with, just by, I actually had looked online and found Annie Grace and her live alcohol experiment. And it was a free program. I did that by myself, didn't tell anybody I was doing it. I just sort of, you know, cracked on and just did the work on the program. I also did some exercise and healthy eating for that month. And that was the sort of break that I needed that made me think, okay, I'm cured now, I'm good. I've given myself 45 days of a break, so I'm not an abnormal drinker, I'm a normal drinker, and I can go back to drinking again. And so I then, you know, did go back to drinking I stopped drinking until the end of September in that year. I went back to drinking in October because it's my birthday month and you cannot not have a drink for your birthday, according to me at the time. And, you know, I couldn't see how anybody could celebrate their birthday without a drink. The thing is with me, my birthday celebrations do tend to go on for more than just the one day. I think usually it's a couple of weeks or a month. And then we went back into lockdown in the UK in the November of 2020. And I then had a taste of what it felt like to have that alcohol-free month, you know, in the August. And I had such amazing sleep. I couldn't get over just how much my stress levels went down at work. I had so much better coping skills. And it just felt like I wanted to be back in that space again. So when the government announced we were going back into lockdown in November of 2020, I thought, I'm going to do this alcohol-free. I've done it once before, I can do it again. And so I went back to the same program and I did that again. And then, of course, Christmas comes along and you think, I can't not drink at Christmas. So, because, you know, that's what I did. And so I went back to drinking over the Christmas period. And then it came to the January of 21 where I thought, right, OK, I've now had two tastes of what it feels like to be alcohol free and to get all of the wonderful benefits even in just 30 days. It was just so amazing. And I just thought, right, I need to do this again. And everybody else is doing that alcohol free January. So it was a good time to do it again. And that was the year that I actually managed to do 5 months. I did join another program. It was an intense program, a small group I did, which gave me a lot more kind of background information on well-being and some resources that you can use to maintain sort of sobriety. But it came to the summer, and then the summer was a trigger for me because everybody's out drinking in the beer gardens and stuff. So, of course, then I end up drinking over the summer. But I have to be honest, in the summer of 21, it was a lot less than any other previous year that I've ever been drinking, because I had already some knowledge and I had the tools to be able to, you know, hold it together a little bit more. I would say, though, you know, even during that summer, I would have periods of maybe trying to not drink for 2 weeks, and then I would end up drinking for a week, you know, 7 days solidly, and then I'd probably take another 3 weeks off. So it was kind of that kind of pattern over the summer. And then it came to the end of the year and I made another decision, because somebody had said, oh, you know, if you stop drinking now, you'll do 100 days by the 1st of January. And so I remember thinking, it would have been early September that year, that if I stop drinking now, I'm going to do 100 days. And I really wanted to get to the 100 days to finish the year off. And so I managed to do 88 days. And then we went on holiday to Florida to go and visit a friend of mine. And my daughter was studying in the US at the time. So we were having a family Christmas together. And I'd managed to get all the way from Heathrow on a plane, alcohol-free, through the lounge, where we had free drinks in the lounge. And I did all of it alcohol-free, got to my friend's house, and he said, he handed me a glass of wine and just said to me, "This is my holiday too. You know, you need to drink with me. And, you know, you can't be drinking any of that rubbish stuff," because I brought a bottle of alcohol-free wine with me. And I just crumbled. And I'd got 88 days alcohol-free at that point. And so that was the point that I then drank over the whole period of time we were there. It was 10 days. And we came back on the plane and I just thought to myself, right, okay, so my sober date is the 28th of December 2021, and it was the day that we came back into the UK. And I made the decision that I was definitely not going to drink on that day, but I also made a decision that I was going to do an entire year on that day, because I thought, I've just realized I have literally just drank for somebody else. And it was a massive realization for me that I have the biggest people-pleasing tendencies, that if you told me to put my hand in a fire, I would do it. And that was the moment. It was almost like that holiday and that drinking episode springboarded me to make that realization that I needed to change my thinking and my behavior, because all of a sudden there was a massive realization that actually other people matter more than me, that actually I don't really matter. And in a way, I think even during that whole 18 months of that moderation attempt, every single one of those drinking episodes taught me something about myself. But this was the biggest one. This was the biggest one that, and the very last drink that I ever had was, you know, that I'm not enough. I am not important enough. Other people matter more than me. And the minute I had that realization, that's where it all started to get better for me.
I just want to ask, are you still a people pleaser? 2.5 years alcohol free, nearly.
Do you know what? I'm actually turning my people pleasing around in a different way. And I'll give you an example of how I've done that. I realised that one of the reasons that I was drinking definitely through the pandemic was because of stress, and it was a way of coping. And I realised that actually a lot of my habits of drinking, even pre-pandemic, were picking up a glass of wine when I got home from work because of stress. And it's because I had a really poor work-life balance. And that is one of the reasons that led me to habit drinking at home and kitchen drinking, if you like, you know, having that bottle of wine in the fridge the whole time. And the realization that I had to also change my work-life balance to relieve that stress. I wouldn't have the stress if my work-life balance was in a better order, if you like, and if I was able to control it. And actually, my husband put it into context for me when he said to me one day, "You're like a bilge pump on the Titanic." He said, "You're frantically pumping."
Baby.
Yeah, I know. This was during the COVID. This was during the pandemic, though. During that COVID first wave, it's not exactly. It doesn't say this all the time to me, but it was just the way that he noticed that I was just working beyond, you know, my hours and everything, and I was putting far too much of my own personal, you know, life into work rather than having any at home. And so he'd said, you know, "You're like a bilge pump on the Titanic, because you're frantically pumping the water out. You're doing a fantastic job, but actually, you know, at the same time, you're not really making that much difference, because, you know, we are slowly, well, I'm not going to say we're sinking, because the NHS did a really good job, but at the same time, it was just chaotic, you know." And it was like, and the thing is, by me doing a job that is going beyond my own job description and going beyond the capabilities of my role, you know, I'm actually creating an unmanageable job for anybody else that might want to step into that. So say, you know, we're not in the pandemic now. I had a really bad work-life balance pre-pandemic, you know, where I would stay at work till 8 o'clock at night and whatever and get those emails done. And you know, the more I realized, the more emails you send, the more emails you get. So I hadn't realized that. That was contributing to my own, you know, poor work-life balance. I was giving myself more work. But actually what I've realized is that I had created the kind of person who thinks you're doing a really good job for other people. So you think you're people pleasing your boss, you think you're people pleasing all of the colleagues that you work with, you think you're people pleasing for even for your patients and everything. But actually what you're doing is, you know, making yourself unwell, and you're creating an unmanageable job for somebody else. So actually I'm a kinder person and a better, much person to please others if I create a role that fits within the job description that I'm meant to be doing. And so therefore, if I got hit by a bus tomorrow, somebody can easily take over my job. They're not going to take over my job and say, what the fuck? I am not doing her job, you know? So actually, you end up turning it around to make sure that what you're doing is you're people pleasing in the right way. You know, you're making other people's lives better because you're pointing out, actually, you know, this is how things are meant to be.
Annie, I want to talk about your work now that you do supporting others. Tell us about that, the blue light stuff.
So, well, this all started when I was 8 months alcohol free, and I happened to be walking through the hospital when they were celebrating Alcohol Awareness Week, and the drug and alcohol team were there with a stall trying to give out information to staff and patients about how to reduce alcohol intake. And I just got chatting to the nurse, and I was so excited to meet somebody that was talking about this. And I think he just, you know, he'd never really met anybody with such enthusiasm for not drinking before. I think he thought I was a bit weird. But he actually asked me, would I...
We get that.
I know. I was really excited to talk to somebody about this. And he just asked me, would I be willing to do some further training as an alcohol champion? I know it's a strange word to champion alcohol, but that's what they call it in the NHS. And what that meant was to go off and do a little bit more training to be able to give brief advice to any patients that we come into contact with that we suspect may just have an alcohol problem or an issue with alcohol. And I suppose in my job as a sonographer, I scan people for fatty livers, you know, and so I'm a very good person to intercept a patient to be able to have that conversation with them. It's something that the NHS isn't particularly doing at the moment. It was unusual for me just to bump into this chap. So now we're having bigger conversations in the hospital about how we can potentially use my role and link up ultrasound with the liver services and the drug and alcohol team. So that was the start of all of this, really, just having that one conversation with this nurse who gave me the alcohol champion training. And then I went on to speak. I wanted to train as a health and wellbeing champion with the trust as well. So linking in with the health and wellbeing team, their focus wasn't really on alcohol. So I've now brought that conversation into the NHS wellbeing sort of conversations that we're having. And when I did my live alcohol experiment, when I was, you know, in my moderation years, if you like, I bumped into a lady on those groups, a lady called Maria, who is a senior police officer. And she came to that sort of alcohol experiment with the same kind of stresses as me, working with the public, and she was in the pandemic as well. So we bonded over our stressful jobs. She's now, you know, I think 3 years alcohol free now. She and I had a conversation about her wanting to do something for the police, and she'd wanted to do an alcohol free January for the police and asked me to be a mentor on that. And so while I was mentoring on her program, which was really successful. You know, she had about 250 police officers on there. I went back to my own trust and to the alcohol team and to the wellbeing team and said, could we potentially do something with the NHS and we extend this program for next year? So we started having conversations in the summer of 23 about us linking in with the police, ambulance crew, fire crew as well, and putting on an alcohol-free January for the emergency services. So we call this the Blue Light Emergency Services Alcohol Experiment, and that was run in January of 24. But pre that happening, I was also involved in the Alcohol Awareness Week in July of 23, and because of my involvement with the drug and alcohol team as their alcohol champion, I was asked to bring in speakers because they were quite interested in this sort of grey area drinking, you know, world, if you like. And I brought in William Porter to do a CPD talk for the staff in July of 23. Yeah, your friend.
Just clang, yeah. Name drop there.
I'll give you
famous author.
I'll give you another clanger. I also brought in Janie Lee Grace.
Amazing.
To come and do a talk to NH staff, not just in London, but actually countrywide. So that was really good because we then, you know, we got into the whole of Alcohol Awareness Week by introducing, you know, sober curiosity, if you like, and this whole grey area spectrum drinking. And I've been asked to help with Alcohol Awareness Week this year as well. We've continued that Blue Light program on. It's still on Facebook. We've got a Facebook group that's been running since January. We had loads of people that were very successful doing the whole month, but quite a number that have continued on for the rest of the year so far, you know. And a lot of these people had said that they'd never managed to do even a week alcohol-free. So to actually continue this far on, it was a really good project because it was following the whole Annie Grace methodology, but it's basically a load of information that's given to people in the mornings. There's a community group where people can have a forum to have a discussion, and then we would have lives in the evenings where we would have coaches come on to have a specific topic of the day that they could just talk about and link in with the coaches. During that January as well, I definitely had a period of growth myself. I know at the beginning we said that I'm absolutely shit scared of getting up and talking publicly, but I ended up having to go live on Facebook to over 700 people for a considerable number of evenings through January. And in fact, one night I was on live with William Porter as well. I was a bit
OMG.
I was starstruck.
Not only that though, 700 people who are, you know, in your profession, you know, these are your colleagues and your peers as well, and I think that always adds an extra layer of stress and pressure.
Yeah, it does. But at the same time, it's just really helpful to know that we are starting with the people that really do need to, you know, to exemplify being alcohol free. Our police officers, our NHS staff, you know, ambulance crew, we've all got really, really stressful jobs. And actually, I think to start with the well-being of these teams was so important to be able to then let that kind of filter down to all of the public and patients that we deal with. You know, we've got to be the forerunners, if you like.
I hope you don't mind me saying, Annie, one of the most encouraging things I've ever heard about OTI came from you, knowing that you were an NHS alcohol champion. No alcohol champion. Yeah, an alcohol champion at the NHS. And you said to me, you went, you know what you guys do at OTI, the NHS should be doing more of this. And I thought, oh my God, I can't believe it. Someone who's actually really high up in the NHS with a really swanky job is saying that they should be doing more of what we're doing. But it's fair to say, isn't it, that actually an outsider might expect that the NHS, and again, not having a go here, it's just that kind of the acceptance of alcohol within society. You'd think the NHS would be further along with this, but you're pushing, aren't you, to really get this to be an important part of the agenda.
Yeah, definitely. And I think, you know, just being in OTI and in groups like this, and I know there's quite a lot of sobriety groups around, but there's almost a force of people coming through now with this middle lane drinking idea. And as you've said as well, Ben, in the past, I've heard you on other podcasts talking about we need to get cleverer at going downstream and pulling people out before they get to that point of that rock bottom or that, you know, real harmful drinking. So in my role as an alcohol champion, we are taught to use what's called the Audit C scale to identify alcohol use in patients. And it's a screening tool that the audit stands for Alcohol Use Disorders Identification Test. That's what audit stands for. And the C is consumption. And the range goes from 0 to 12. So if you, there's three questions that are asked. And if you score between 0 and 4, you are lower risk, which I suppose we'd call no normal drinkers, if you like. And those people would be drinking less than 14 units, which is the government's national average suggested for both males and females. And so you, if you're drinking less than 14 units, you'd be score 0 to 4. 5 to 7, they're classified as increasing risk, and 8 to 10 as higher risk. And then 11 to 12 would be possible dependence. And at the moment, the NHS only really provides onward support for any patients that score 11 and 12. And so really, if you look at the scores between 5 and 10, which for the increasing risk and the higher risk, this is us. We are the middle lane drinkers. We are the grey area drinkers. We're the ones that are going to potentially need that onward support if we score 11 and 12 on that audit C scale. And so really, you know, I think what we need to be doing is a little bit more in terms of raising awareness to the public and patients to be able to stop people needing NHS support, because it's putting a lot of pressure onto NHS services. Since I've stopped drinking, I realized just how many of the kind of symptoms of a hangover, you know, and also long-term chronic alcohol use is potentially going to bung up the NHS services and waiting lists, you know. And so it's about recognizing that actually we can stop people developing chronic alcohol use and needing to use NHS services, then, you know, and stopping people just getting to that dependent stage and needing that onward support, which is what the NHS is only able to supply that at the moment. You know, if you come in to A&E and they do this audit screening test on you and you score less than 11, you're given a leaflet and you're sent home.
I'm really glad you brought that up, Annie, because this is something we've talked about before and it absolutely drives me nuts, because I've just very quickly done the audit C, and if I was me 4 years ago, and I would have come out with a 9, so I would have been higher risk, but you know, that nothing would have really happened if I'd come out with a 9, you know.
Yeah, and so we do need to, you know, start educating the public to make the choices, you know, that nobody's being coming at you with a rolling pin telling you've got to stop drinking. You know, that's not the thing here. You know, we've actually got to just educate people and give them the awareness of what alcohol is doing to them, so that we can actually, you know, allow people to make the decisions themselves. You know, do I want to drink? Do I not want to drink? We know that moderation is difficult, you know, but we've got the knowledge that a lot of people don't have. It's giving people that knowledge. So in my role as an alcohol champion, I am actually meant to have a discussion with a patient that would score highly on the audit C screening test and be able to give them advice about how they might actually reduce their alcohol intake, but also about the benefits of not drinking. And so it's interesting that, you know, I had that chance encounter with a nurse in the hospital foyer during Alcohol Awareness Week that led me to do the alcohol champion training. And I'm a sonographer, and they're not offering this to all sonographers who are scanning livers, who could potentially be saving people in the future. You know, there's a lot of really good ideas that could come out of this. And actually, the NHS isn't really sort of linking in and offering this training to all staff, because we should be all screening patients, because everybody drinks, most people drink alcohol. I've got some stats actually. I think I've told you before that my husband's in the process of writing a book. Well, he's written it. It's with the publishers. It will be out next year, I think. But supposedly the stats that...
Why We Drink, yeah, if I remember rightly from a chat.
The book's going to be called Why We Drink Too Much.
Why We Drink Too Much. We had a chat about this on Snowden.
Yeah.
It's cool. And, it's great. To be released not just in the UK, but the US as well.
Absolutely, yeah. It's going worldwide. But supposedly the stats that he's given me is that 82% of adults in the UK drink, 49% drink regularly, and these came from the Office of National Statistics. So these are not just his figures pulled out of the air. 66% and two-thirds of US adult population consumed alcohol in the last year. So, I mean, you know, there's a huge number of people who are drinking and who could be screened and given just the awareness of what is potentially available to them if they can cut back or stop completely.
No, but this is like, I lied. I've just looked at it and I'm nearly 4 years alcohol free, but I just did the audit C and I said, I'm a 9. Actually, if I'm being really honest, I'm a 10, maybe even an 11. You know, so even me, who's now 4 years alcohol free, is doing that because it's a test where you're at, you know, that's the analysis and I've got to be honest with you. You know, but I lied then as well. Yeah. So when you take that into account, and I didn't lie out of, you know, I'm going to fool Annie. I lied out of, oh God, do I really want to be a... Don't you want to be a 10? You know, and that's what we're also dealing with here, isn't it?
Stigma and shame and judgment and everything else. And we could do another hour about all that, couldn't we? How we play it down for fear of what? For fear of being judged, you know, because if you're taking these tests and I don't know, is that you want the help maybe, or you want somebody to go, actually, it's going to be okay. You can do this. But still, anybody with any sort of issue with alcohol, you know, it's still riddled.
Yeah.
Riddled with bloody finger pointing and shame. And it shouldn't be.
It's you've got to assume that if someone's an 8, they're actually a 10. If someone's a 9, they're actually an 11.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Yeah. Like,
I'm not even going to do the test, FYI. I'm not doing it. I don't need to.
There's definitely the issue of maybe whether people are not being honest with when they're doing these tests. But also, I think there's a big issue with people not understanding units, you know, and the fact that I'm an NHS person. I've worked for the NHS for 32 years, and pre giving up drinking alcohol, I wouldn't have been able to tell you what 14 units was. I had absolutely no idea. I would have thought that was 14 glasses of wine that I'm allowed to have. But actually, you know, having done the alcohol training that I do now, I can tell you that those 14 units in terms of wine drinkers, if you're drinking a 13% bottle of wine, that is 1.5 bottles of wine a week you should only be drinking.
Half of a small glass of wine is one unit.
Yes, but who drinks
a pint is one unit.
Who drinks a small glass of wine? So ideally, what we should be thinking is the majority of people that drink, you know, a medium glass of wine is 2.4 units. Okay, that's 2.4 units for just that one glass of wine. So, you know, and the other thing to think about here as well is that the body can only really process one unit per hour. So this is the reason why they say that binge drinking is actually worse for you than actually spreading it out during the week, because your body can't physically process all of those units. And so, you know, the problem is we've got to really sort of get our head around. I know units are not really helpful because it's just, you know, you're only talking about consumption. And actually, the other thing I did want to talk about here, and that is the fact that, you know, we need to get better at not just looking at consumption, but at looking at the consequence of drinking alcohol in terms of the hazards and the harms that it creates for us, but also control. So are people able to control their alcohol use? So at the moment, the Audit C scale that I've been talking about really only deals with consumption, and it looks at whether people are either excessive or binge drinkers. That's what it's trying to identify. And then it's able to offer the support to the really heavy drinkers. But actually, what we should be doing is really teaching the public about what are the potential hazards and harms.
Oh, she's just getting out the manuscript here for why do we drink too much?
Well, the thing is, the Alcohol Change UK and the Alcohol Awareness Week, the theme this year is alcohol and harm. And it will be interesting to see what kind of things come out in this, because the people automatically assume that harm caused by alcohol is, you know, that kind of liver disease, you're in hospital, you know, you've reached cirrhosis stage, you've got, you know, but harm is so much more. You know, you've got to think about harm in terms of harm to the person, to the individual. So, you know, that is accidental injury. Have you crashed your car and whatever, but also it's more in terms of your personal physical health, your personal mental health, your loss of gain, you know, your income or your job or your education, relationship problems, financial troubles, criminal convictions if you've gone that far. These are the harm to the person. And then the harm to others would be things like accidental injury, violence, including domestic, your mental, you know, harm that you might cause to other people by your drinking, mm-hmm. any financial harm that you're going to cause because you're, you know, drinking away the wages in the family or whatever, and neglect of your family. This is all harm.
And then the societal harm, Annie, the societal harm of the, you know, the resources that it takes to police town centres with people getting pissed on a Saturday night, the extra burden it places on A&E departments. You know, you could just go on and on and on and on.
I'll give you some more stats on that, actually, because the NHS costs of alcohol are 3.5 billion per year. The alcohol-related crime is 11 billion per year,
right.
Billion pounds per year. And then UK societal costs is 21 billion per year. And these are facts and figures that Charlie has researched for his book.
Please send me an email with all these on, Annie. This is yeah. Great. This is gold.
Okay.
This is absolute gold. But that's crazy. 21 billion per year.
Yeah, and in the US, it's even more. So the economic burden for the USA is 250 billion lost due to productivity, crime, incarceration, and increased healthcare utilization of services. I mean, it's huge. So the harm is so enormous. And I think that what we've got to consider when we talk about, you know, looking at people's alcohol use is not just consumption like the NHS do at the moment. We should be looking at the consequences, so the harms and the hazards. And then control really needs to come down to, you know, we talk about control in the NHS about whether you're dependent on alcohol. You know, are you dependent or are you not dependent? I wasn't somebody that got up in the morning and needed a glass of wine. I didn't reach for it, you know, during the day. I just had a habit of drinking because of stress relief, for stress relief. But actually, reliance can become addiction. And so what we need to do is, like as you said before about going downstream and pulling them out, Ben, we need to be looking at a new way of asking people questions that are not just about how much they're drinking, but how much are they relying on alcohol?
Yeah. And what's it actually impacting in terms of their day-to-day life? Yeah, you're right. Because the other side of this, Annie, and look, we've got to wrap up soon because we will talk about this forever. And maybe we should take it over to a premium pod. Anyway, that's a thought for another day. But it's also, you know, I am a, and I know that, you know, men and women, it's at the same time, you know, I'm a 6 foot bloke who's probably got, you know, a couple of extra stone, but I've got a bit to shift weight wise. You know, I'm a big bloke, you know, me compared to 5'5", small framed, you know, that's, it affects me massively differently to how it affects another bloke. Just because we're both men doesn't mean that it's going to affect us in the same way. Oh, Annie, we could talk.
Can I finish on
this? Please,
this is really important,
do.
And I think people would really like to hear this. But my husband has got this new scoring system that he thinks we need to put into common usage to be able to start looking at, especially grey area drinking and that middle lane drinking, is to think of these 7 questions. And if you say yes to any of these, then actually, there can potentially be help, or we need to have awareness that we probably do need to think about looking at our alcohol usage. So I rely on a drink to make me feel at ease or to feel calm. Is that yes or no? I rely on a drink to fit in, to socialize. I rely on a drink to de-stress, for example, after work. I rely on a drink to enjoy life, to have fun. I rely on a drink to feel happy, better about myself. I rely on a drink in a way that makes me worried about future consequences. I rely on a drink in a way that makes me worried whether I could stop or moderate. And if the answer to those is yes, or I think you mentioned that you've got to score it out of seven, the 7 points. And I'm not 100% sure, you know, to be honest with you, if there's just a one or a two in any of those, there is a reliance. And I think that's what we've got to look at now, is that we shouldn't be looking at dependence. We should be talking about reliance, you know, because a lot of us are reliant upon alcohol for a particular reason. And it's about, you know, just raising that awareness of what is that reliance and what could you do about it instead. So for me, it's been about really looking at, you know, what do I do for stress relief now instead? What do I do to resolve my work-life balance? What do I do to ensure that, you know, the reasons that I was drinking before, for me, it was mostly stress relief, I think. But I know, you know, a lot of people drink for loneliness. A lot of people drink for extra fun, you know, because there's things missing in their lives. It's almost like, let's look at what you're relying on the alcohol for. Just have awareness of what that is. And then the next sort of steps for you would be, what am I going to do about it? So I think if we could bring a reliance scale into the NHS, we're going to really save a lot of people. And so that's my job, is really to have these kind of conversations with my organization and the people that I'm working with, and to really start getting people to start thinking about, you know, looking at how we're going to help people stopping getting to that real dependent stage in the future.
Annie, it's been an absolute pleasure. And it is genuinely one of those episodes that we could quite easily do another hour on. Two things. We're going to have to chat again at some point in the future, without a doubt. And also, we're going to extend an invitation to your husband as well to join us on the podcast, because it sounds like he's got so much to share. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Fantastic. Annie, we feel really lucky, myself and Ben, that you found Over the Influence and that you listened to the podcast. And you gave the community a chance, because we benefit so much from what you bring, as do our community members. So for myself and Ben, genuinely, thank you. It's a joy to know you, and it's been such a pleasure to chat. Final quick question from me. How would you sum up the last couple of years for you, now you've removed the alcohol and you are no longer reliant?
Do you know, I'm actually a completely different person. And I know that sounds really weird, because I seem to remember, is it Maz that said, being alcohol free is meant to be the least interesting
thing? It's the least interesting thing about me. That's the one.
I've just told you, my life has changed, you know, at work and what I'm doing at work. Being alcohol free is one of the most interesting things about me. So I'm kind of the opposite. It's actually created this whole new narrative, new relationships, new friendships, new everything. My world has expanded since I've become alcohol free. And so, you know, I just cannot believe just how many wonderful things are happening to me. And so, yeah, from being somebody that was worried about coming on here because I really thought that I had a pretty normal life and no rock bottom and whatever, you know, to be able to tell you that actually being alcohol free is leading me to some of the most amazing work experiences and helping to almost shape the NHS. It's pretty good, you know?
Pretty good.
It's fantastic. It's brilliant. Thank you. Annie, final question, I lied. Where can people find further information about everything that you've just shared with us?
So if people just want to follow me on socials, they can follow me at AF_RainbowRider. Or if people want to know more about how they can join the Blue Light Alcohol Experiment, they can email me at annie@soberrainbowrider.com.
Amazing. Annie Knowles from London, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for your time.
Great to see you.
Bye.